That took me by surprise. All together now, here's the verse for the year. Adore and obey Jesus, or reverence him in your heart. Be ready to tell anyone who asks for why you've got this hope within you, to give an account for the way and the why of how you live. Why do you live the way that you do? I did something very unusual yesterday. I found myself at Lavenot Garage talking to Pat Jerome about the servicing schedule, that's difficult to say, on my car. And I have never worried about servicing schedules ever before in my life. I don't read instructions. I certainly don't obey instructions. I dislike having German car manufacturers tell me to put my seatbelt on and to beep in my ear in order that I do it. My attitude to mechanical things is to literally run them into the ground. I'm not advocating that, and I'm declaring to you what a reformed character I am, because I found this strange thing called an owner's manual in the pocket of the car. And the reason that I did that was an enormous great spanner picture arrived on the dashboard of my car, and I ignored it for about 3 months. It was nice of them to give me a picture of a spanner. But then it started making a beeping noise, which did in the end get on my nerves. So it prompted me to go and find out what all this was about. And it was explained to me that you're supposed to service your car and that there are manufacturer's instructions. So I said to Pat, well, do you think I should do that? And he said, well, it's up to you, but I think it would be wise. The manufacturer knows more about it probably than you do. And so I'm grateful, Alison, for your picture that you shared, because what I want to bring to us this morning is something out of the owner's manual, the person, the God who made us and understands how we tick. And if you're like me and you tend to just run and run and run and then wonder why sometimes you conk out, like you run and run your car and then you wonder why it conks out, then this word is for you. I know that nearly all of you are delighted when you hear that I'm coming up to preach. It's the highlight of your week. But I also just had a strange sense standing over there, almost inconceivable, I know. But I felt like the Lord was saying to me, just to say to somebody who doesn't like the way that I preach, who when it's me, they think, oh no, I wish it was Johnny or John James or Simon Jennings or anybody other than Steve. And I just want to ask you, if that's you, to try and look past me this morning and hear the word of God. Because I just had a sense that I find it really difficult to believe that there's anybody in that mindset about me. But I just have a sense that there is some peculiar person, but that the Lord wants to speak to you through what he's given me to say this morning. So just, if that's for you, try and ignore the fact it's me. Imagine it's Simon up here talking and hear what the Lord wants to say to you. Jesus sat his disciples down on a mountain in the north of the country. It's a bit like holding a kind of a session up on the mountains in Snowdon. And his disciples were there, and a group of other people who had been kind of hanging out with them were listening in. And this is what we call the Sermon on the Mount. And this is where we're basing quite a lot of what we teach over the coming months in. And you'll remember, those of you who are familiar with Matthew 5, that Jesus said to his disciples, you're the salt of the earth. You're the light of the world. Therefore, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. It's the same as our verse for the year, yeah? Live your lives in such a way that people wonder why you're doing it and they give glory to God and maybe they come and encounter God for themselves. And having said that, he then takes the Ten Commandments, which is the law that the Jews of his day tried to live by, and he says something really quite interesting to me. It won't be interesting to the person who hates my preaching, but again, bear with me. Do not think, Jesus said, that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. And he actually goes on to say that there's not one iota of the scriptures that Jesus wants to eradicate or cross out. And that was speaking right into a current debate that was going on between the theologians of the day. They had this funny little debate going on about a letter called Yod. I can't pronounce it properly. But anyway, Jesus was speaking into a debate between the law teachers of the day, some of whom said that the law of Moses could be set aside or parts of it could be ignored, and others said, no, you need to live it in all its fullness. And Jesus sides with this group. He says, don't think that I've come to abolish anything about the law of God. I've come to live it out, to fulfill it. And then he says to his disciples, and unless you do the same, you're not really followers of me. I'm paraphrasing the next bit that's up there. So he says, you need to do better than the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, otherwise you certainly won't enter the kingdom of heaven. And then, some of you remember, he takes the Ten Commandments and he essentially says, you were told by Moses, do this, I'm telling you to do that, but there's a whole lot more to it than you imagined if you just listened to Moses. And this is what we're homing in on today. So Exodus 20 says, you will not commit adultery. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not be jealous of anything that your neighbour has, including his wife or her husband or their kids or their car or whatever it is. The law of Moses also said that if two people commit adultery, they have to be put to death. And it says that you need to stone the adulterers and get rid of them from your community. Jesus says, well, you've heard all that. You heard it was said, do not commit adultery. You shall not commit adultery. But I tell you, anyone who looks lustfully at a woman has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And again, this for the disciples, they know of the debate which is going on between the rabbis of the day about what actually constitutes adultery. It's a bit like the church. The church has been appallingly bad at kind of sticking its nose in to the mechanics of people's sex lives over 2,000 years. And I'm not a fan of that, okay? But these rabbis were having a discussion about exactly where do you draw the line? When does adultery become adultery and when is it not? And Jesus said, well, hold on a minute, folks. You haven't understood the half of it. It's, even if you look at a woman with lust in your heart, then that's adultery as far as I'm concerned. He kind of took it and he just upped the ante 100-fold. And then he says, so if your right eye causes you to sin or stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And then he says the same about your hand. And the disciples heard this. And I can imagine they felt a bit like this poor guy. What are you saying, Jesus? There are a number of times when Jesus' disciples said, man, this is just, we can't handle this. Who can possibly be a follower of yours if this is what you're asking? And there were times, you remember, those of you who know your scriptures, that people turned away and said, we just can't do this. And I think this was one of those moments. And it would apply in our society. Imagine going out there today and saying, well, adultery is a bad thing, but actually, if you just have lustful thoughts, that's adultery. Statistics are very difficult to get on how many people commit adultery for kind of quite understandable reasons. And so I've been looking at the research on this. Goodness knows what my Google record looks like over the last week. They're no doubt coming for me, but it's all for good reasons, folks. But the sociological studies that are done on this say that somewhere between 20 and 76% of men will commit, UK men will commit adultery at some point in their lives. So some people kind of plump for the middle somewhere and say, best guess, more than half of men commit adultery in our society today, and nearly half of women. And it doesn't take a mathematical genius to work out that means nearly half of marriages are impacted in some way or another by adultery in our society today. And we have a teacher, Jesus, who's saying to us, it's not just the act of adultery, it's the thought of adultery that is offensive to God. That's a hard message in Jesus' day. It's an even harder message in our day. So why is Jesus so tough on adultery? And I want to say that Jesus spends very little of his time talking about sex. So we're focusing today on one little bit of Jesus' teaching. The church is accused of obsessing on sex. Jesus certainly didn't. There were far more, if you just judge by his teaching, there were things that he was much more steamed up about than this. But he was very clear. For the rabbis of his day, it was primarily an issue of theft, because they lived in a very paternalistic society where men were very much more superior, more powerful than women. And if you read the law of Moses, it's pretty clear that it's largely about protecting the rights of a husband whose wife has somebody else commit adultery with them, or if it's an unmarried woman, it's about protecting the rights of the father who could expect a dowry for marrying off a daughter who was a virgin. But there's still a part of this which is, if you or I commit adultery, it's an act of theft against the person who's married to the person who we commit adultery with. Yeah? And for me, reading the scriptures, it feels like that was the main preoccupation of these Pharisees. It was about the rights of the men who were married to or fathers of women who had sex outside of marriage. Also importantly for them, it destroyed the fabric of their society. And that's relevant today. So if nearly half of marriages are affected in one way or another by adultery, the kids of those marriages, the other partner in those marriages, adultery is an insidious thing which eats away at the roots of individuals' lives, of families, of communities. And that's why Jesus is tough on adultery, because he cares about our lives and he's angry at the devil who comes to kill and steal and destroy. And adultery is a powerful weapon for the devil to do that. But thirdly, and I think Jesus takes those things for granted almost, but for Jesus he takes it back to God's original design. And he says, in the beginning he created the male and female. He put a woman and a man together for their mutual blessing and to help each other. And so the act of adultery is a violation of how God originally intended things to be. It goes right against God's plan, God's design for creation. And I love this about Jesus. He also hates it because it objectifies women. And that would have been a million miles away from the thoughts of his male hearers, but who said, we would like women to cover up, please. Because if I see a woman with lovely hair, this is not me, this is the Pharisees, I might be tempted to lust. So the solution is for the woman to cover herself up rather than me to sort out the state of my heart. And Jesus says, no, I'm telling you, whoever looks lustfully at a woman. And that's great about Jesus. He's kind of going right against the assumptions of his day. I read yesterday about a Hollywood actress who complaining that she's too attractive to get serious roles. She's so sexy she can't get serious parts. It's a terrible problem I've had as well. Most of the jobs I've been... when I've been unsuccessful in interviews, that's usually been the reason, I think. Although they've never fed that back to me. But. And this woman, I can't pronounce her surname because it's too complicated. Her first name's Emily. I mean, she's been a bit complicit in the fact that she's been objectified. But nevertheless, our society does a huge amount, doesn't it, to objectify women and men. And that has consequences. Look at teenagers today and their preoccupation with body shape. You look at people who self-harm because they just don't think that they live up. And that's another reason why Jesus hates an over-sexualized society, a way of looking at people, looking lustfully at people and desiring them because of what they look like rather than because of who they are. So for all those reasons, Jesus is rightly tough on adultery. But I think the killer for Jesus is that having lustful thoughts is in your heart breaking a covenant which you've made if you're married to your partner. And that matters immensely to God because he's a covenant-keeping God. And the covenant between a married man and a married woman, a couple, is a reflection of God's covenant with you and with me and with his people. So when mentally you or I slip off the wedding ring, if we're married, we'd slip it off if we're not, then we're living out something which God just hates. And the Old Testament has far, far more to say about the spiritual adultery of God's people in deserting him and worshipping other gods than it ever does about the physical sexual act of adultery. Is Jesus just talking to married men then? Well, the strict answer is yeah, his audience was largely married men. The language that he was using was speaking into the lives of those disciples and saying, this is how I want you to behave. And the consequences in the Mosaic law for fornication are different to those of adultery. So fornication, sex before marriage, adultery, sex once you're married. There was a different price to pay. And again, you see the way in which this is set up in the favour of the men. So if a man seduced a virgin, he wasn't stoned to death, and nor was she, but he had to marry her and pay the dowry. It's protecting the rights of the dad who expected to be able to get something out of this. But the New Testament is pretty clear, I think. It talks about all forms of immorality, sexual and otherwise. And I think we can extend the principle which Jesus applies to adultery here to pretty much anything that God would find offensive. So it's the act is important, but the intention to act or the harbouring thoughts about the act is equally important. So I suspect it's not just about men lusting over women, it's women lusting after men. It's not just about married people, it's about single people. I'm sorry, if you've got a calendar of firemen with their hoses, I suspect that you're kind of included in this. So greed, sex, women, men, same sex, opposite sex, it all applies. Jesus has just taken the Pharisees' concept of adultery, and as I say, he's just blown it wide in a way which I suspect makes nearly all of us adulterers. That's the Sermon on the Mount. That's the message in the north, Snowdonia, if you like, to his group of disciples. But then something really extraordinary happens. In a different setting, in the south of the country, in the capital city, Jesus sits down to teach in the temple. I don't know, take my picture of Snowdonia, and maybe Jesus has come down to the St. David's Centre. That's where people go to worship now, isn't it? And he sat down in a corner, and something quite different happens. It says he sat down to teach them. He sat down in both occasions. It's what rabbis did when they taught. They sat down. He knew what he was doing. He was taking on authority as a teacher. He sat down to teach them. He was talking to anyone who was around, and suddenly the Pharisees and the teachers of the law burst in, dragging with them a woman who, it says, has been caught in the very act of adultery. And they say, what are we going to do with her then, Jesus? Moses said to stone adulterers to death. What do you say? Some great things about this story. First of all of the early Gospels left it out. So, John 8, 1-11 isn't proper scripture then. I might have thought like that a few years ago, but I was thinking about this week. Somebody knew this story about Jesus' life through the oral tradition that the disciples handed down. They looked at the four Gospels and they thought, hang on, this is such an important story that we know about the life of Jesus that we've got to go and add it in. And it's just about one of only two or three occasions where people have added into the Gospels a few years after the Gospels were actually written. I actually love that about this story. It was such an important event in the ministry of Jesus that the Gospel writers all missed it. And somebody else says, well, I'm going to put it in because it's really important for future generations to know about. So rather than downplaying this story, I think the fact that it wasn't in there at the beginning is really, really interesting. And praise God for the person who had the courage to put it in. Secondly, the teachers of the law didn't care at all about the case of this woman. Nobody stoned adulterers by the time of Jesus. But they were setting him a trap because the Romans were the ruling authorities and they were the only ones who had the right to put somebody to death. So they're setting one of these traps for Jesus. If he says, yeah, stone her, then the Romans are going to be down on him like a ton of bricks. And he's right in the middle of the Roman stronghold in the city of Jerusalem. They've got a reason to hand him over to the authorities and have him put to death. If he says no, he's immediately a liberal theologian who doesn't any longer believe in the law of Moses, and he's directly contradicting what he'd said in the north in the Sermon on the Mount when he said, nothing about the law is to be overturned, I've come to fulfill it. So they found this woman, they thought, I know what we can do with this. He's teaching in the temple, let's take her along. And some of you know the story. What Jesus did was to, first of all, get out of his teaching seat and crouch down on the ground where they'd thrown the woman in front of him. And he started to write in the ground. Nobody knows what he wrote. Why did he do it? Well, it doesn't say. But I'm pretty sure he does it to deflect attention away from this woman. So this woman is thrown into the middle of the group. All eyes are on her. Jesus, what are you going to do about her? What I'm going to do is get down in the dirt with her. And I'm going to draw attention. What's he doing? And they begin to... This woman's suddenly out of the spotlight. He says an amazingly wise thing. So he says, any of you who are without sin, cast the first stone. And it doesn't say any of you who haven't committed adultery. It's not the specific sin of adultery in the words that are used in the gospel story. It's any of you who have never sinned in any way. And it's great. It says the oldest of them drifted off first, and eventually even the young, enthusiastic, confident, immortal ones drifted off too. And he turns around and he says, well, where have they all gone? And she says, they've cleared off. And he says, well, I don't condemn you either then if they don't. But go away and don't sin anymore. I love the story for all sorts of reasons. Really, really interesting that she hangs around after they've all gone. How am I doing on time? Because I find all this so interesting. I must move on. She could easily have scarpered, yeah? They've all gone. He's still scribbling in the ground. He seems to be a bit nuts. I can get out of here. She hangs around to hear what Jesus is going to say to her. And we'll come back to that in a minute. But this, we've got a curious kind of thing going on here. So in the north, it's tough on the act of adultery or even thoughts of adultery. In the south, on a different day, it seems to be, oh, it's all right. I'll let you off then, but don't do it anymore. Suddenly Jesus has gone soft on sin, which backs up what one of the criticisms that was made of him, which is that he was a friend of sinners. He hung around in pubs. He spent his time with taxpayers who fiddled their taxes and extorted other people. He was comfortable in the company of prostitutes. They assumed he didn't know who these people were, but of course he did. And he was a friend of sinners. I've got a lot of time for Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He's the first black archbishop of Cape Town in South Africa, human rights activist, Nobel Prize winner. He's retired now, but still active. He said, we may be surprised at the people we find in heaven. God has a soft spot for sinners. His standards are quite low. And you can imagine, those of you who know Desmond Tutu from the telly, you can imagine him chuckling as he says that. I agree with the first two sentences. I disagree profoundly with the third. Even though it's Desmond Tutu, and sorry, Desmond Tutu, and you've achieved far more than I ever will, but I don't think that's what these two stories show us. Jesus has a soft spot for sinners. He's a friend of sinners, thank goodness. But his standards are incredibly high. So the standard he sets in Matthew 5 is unbelievably high, and the compassion and the love that he shows for sinners in John 8 is amazingly gracious and beyond belief too. And we kind of, I think, well, if God forgives me, it must be that the sin doesn't matter very much. But Jesus holds those intentions. The sin matters incredibly more than we could ever imagine to God. It's so offensive to God that we couldn't get our heads around it. And yet he loves us so much that he's willing to forgive us. So the depth of our sin and the height of God's love are massively, wildly apart from how we and those around us can imagine. He has a soft spot for sinners, but his standards are incredibly high. And I think we need to get our heads round the not condemning of John 8 whilst not condoning a la Matthew 5. And in fact, also in John 8:11. Okay, I don't condemn you, but don't sin anymore. I'm winding up, but I think this has three applications for us. One is for the church. Another is for the sinner, in which I include myself. And the third is for the sinned against. I don't remember many sermons that I preach, which is probably a good thing. Some of you come up to me and you say, do you remember when you said blah, blah, blah? And I go, no. That's just how it is. I'm glad that you remember them. But there are a few that I do. and I'm going to refer to one in a moment. I've been thinking this week about different kinds of church. I've been thinking about something which I call fortress church. And I've experienced of a fortress church. Let me briefly describe it to you. You okay for another 5 or 10 minutes, including the person who doesn't like my preaching? 3 people have nodded, I'll take that as. So fortress church, okay, is a place which is an enclave. It has a siege mentality. You can go into a fortress church and you can feel safe from the outside world. You probably have a powerful preacher, not me, or an authoritative leader, Simon, and that person probably tells you how to live your life. It's quite a comfortable place to be in a way. And what you have is a very high level of conformity. We probably all think the same, we'll like the same songs. In extraordinary cases, people even start to dress the same. I remember some of these churches. I'm old enough to remember these churches from the 1970s and 80s. You got people, there was a church I was in where the elders all wore the same jumper at one stage. It was hilarious even. Not the same, not one. I mean, they had 5 same pattern. They weren't all squeezed into the same garment. But, and there's a place for fortress church. I think for people who have been badly damaged, people having really tough times, it's great to be able to go and to be safe and protected somewhere. So I'm not dissing fortress church. But I'm saying I don't think that's what the Lord has called Eden to be. We need to be a safe place. We need to be a place where we know that God is our stronghold and our protector. But I don't get the sense that we are called to be a fortress church. If we are, you need to find a more kind of dictatorial leader than you've probably got at the moment, I hope. So another model is family church. And a lot of us experience family church. A lot of us love family church. The church is like a big family and you're welcomed in. And I've benefited at phases of my life from being welcomed into other people's families. I've lived with other people's families as part of them. And it's fantastic that God puts the lonely into families, the scriptures say. And he's done that for me. And he does that through an expression of church, which is family. And probably a lot of our roots are in what we might call a family-style church. It doesn't mean it's always family-friendly, but the feel of it is family. Come and join us. Come and join us around the meal table. Come and be part of us. And I don't want to knock that either, and I want us to retain that. But I want to suggest that that's not enough for what the Lord is calling Eden to be. Because in a family, you have kind of shared stories, shared heritage, you have in-jokes. And if you want, as an outsider, to become part of that family, you need to kind of join in. That's what I did when I lived with this lovely family, with Auntie Anita and Uncle Derek and their kids. Okay, but I was always slightly on the outside because I hadn't been with them camping in the New Forest in 1980, whatever it was. Yeah, and they had their own jokes about when one of the hamsters escaped and so on. And I just feel that if we're only a family church, really quite difficult for people to come in and to become part of our community. And I just have a sense this week, the Lord is calling us. I've struggled for another F, but we'll call it a finding church, or if you want, a going and a finding church. And the sermon which I preached on the 8th of January 2012 brought out an extraordinary verse to me. I didn't really understand what it meant, but I said, I believe that the Lord is saying to this church, I will give you the treasures of darkness, riches stored in secret places. People who we haven't found yet, people who don't know about the Lord, people who don't know about church. And I have a sense the Lord is wanting us to be a seeking out and a finding church. It's great that people from a church background come back and join in God's community and reconnect with him. Fantastic. So brilliant. But there's more than that for this church. And if we're going to be that kind of church, we need to get this balance between not condemning and not condoning. We need to understand Matthew 5 and we need to understand John 8. We need to be able to accept people in, but give them time with Jesus to hear what he says to them. We don't throw stones. We back off. We leave them with Jesus and he says to them what he wants to say to them. And the limited hair that I have on the back of my neck is standing up as I say this. I have a strong witness that this is what the Lord is saying to us as a church. And for many of us that will mean breaking old mindsets, setting aside old assumptions, dealing with our prejudices and being a lot more flexible than we've been accustomed to being. It's not that we drop the standard like Desmond Tutu wants to, but it's that we up the compassion, the love, the inclusivity, the ability to deal with diversity and difference, the ability to completely accept and love and walk alongside people who don't share our views, don't have our same in-jokes, don't wear the same clothes, don't have the same accents, whatever it is. It's going to be a big ask for us, but I'm really, really excited about it. And then there's an application for those of us who are affected in one way or another by adultery. It's interesting to me, only 12% of people in the last social attitude survey in Britain reported that they thought that sex outside marriage was mostly or always wrong. That compares to 28% in 1984. Society's moved a huge way in terms of its tolerance of sex outside marriage. But interestingly, two-thirds of people still think that adultery is mostly or always wrong. And that's in the opposite direction to the past. In 1984, apparently 58% of people reported that. So we need to somehow work out how we're a seeking, a finding church in a society that mostly thinks adultery is still wrong, but doesn't have very many problems at all with sex outside marriage. Keep the standard high, but we keep the standard of love high too. And we need to find ways to introduce people to the handbook, to the owner's manual. People like me who leave it in the drawer of the car and don't even know it's there. But if you've never read the manual, how are you going to know? If you're thrown out of the car before you even get the manual out, how's that going to help you? If Pat Jerome had said, well, if you're not prepared to even look at the manual, get out of my garage. Actually, it would have saved me 200 quid, but that's a different story. So those of us who call ourselves disciples of Jesus sit round him on the mountain in Matthew 5, and we need to be ruthless about our personal purity. James says, get rid of all moral filth and evil that is so prevalent and humbly accept the word of God, the handbook, the manual, which he's planted in you and which can save you. If you're struggling with this, James goes on to say, confess your sins to one another. The great thing about this is we're in it together. The fantastic thing is it's quite hard to harbour lustful thoughts if you're going to go and tell your mate every week when you do that. Believe me. So openness and transparency and mutual support to live the life of high calling of purity in all areas of our lives, not just sex. We need one another to do this, but we shouldn't compromise with ourselves in terms of our aspiration to live that out. But thirdly, it doesn't need a word of knowledge to know that some of us here this morning have been damaged by adultery. And I don't understand why, but I know that adultery reverberates down the generations. I know it from my own experience and from my own family. One of my great-grandfathers ran two families at once. And part of me thinks he must have been crazy, but part of me knows that that had reverberations down the generations, down into my life, and I've had prayer about that to break the curse that Helen talked about. Scriptures say third and fourth generations reap what's done by the first generation. It's true in my life. I was the fourth generation. I've been set free from that. And it's not a tricky thing once the king moves in and sets you free. But we shouldn't underestimate the power of adultery to reverberate down the generations. We shouldn't underestimate the fact that if you've been on the receiving end of a partner who's committed adultery, that will have harmed you. And maybe you've got it sorted, and I have no desire at all, believe me, to go poking around in pain. But it's important that we know that Jesus is there to minister to those of us who have been harmed by adultery. I woke up this morning and I thought, I really don't want to say this. And the Lord popped into my mind, it's okay. Tell them that I know what it's like to be a victim of adultery. And I've put up there a passage from Isaiah 57, where God talks through the prophet Isaiah about the pain which God himself feels because of his people having deserted him. And in God's own words, having committed adultery against God himself. So if you've suffered, if you're the child of a relationship which has suffered, the good news which God's mandated me to share this morning, I believe, as I woke up, is that he knows exactly what that pain feels like. Again, the Apostle James says that God is jealous of us, and it stirs up anger in his heart when we commit adultery against him in terms of switching our focus and our allegiance to the world rather than God. The Lord even called out a prophet and said, I'm going to give you a miserable life, Hosea. I want you to marry an unfaithful woman and live out what it's like to be in an adulterous relationship, because I want to show people how much the adultery of my people hurts me. So if you're affected by this, God says to you, I know how it feels. I've been there many, many times. I felt the anger, I felt the jealousy, I felt the pain, I felt the betrayal, and I'm here to set you free. And just like we're told to get rid of all moral filth, the verse I just quoted, those of us who are on the receiving end of this, who are the victims, are encouraged to get rid of all bitterness, rage, anger, brawling, slander, along with every form of malice, says Paul in Ephesians. Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as Christ has forgiven you. So I want to encourage you by saying that I've finished, but to encourage you more than that by saying, if it's touching your life this morning, this whole question, either because you struggle with not committing the sin yourself or because you've been on the receiving end, the Lord is here for you this morning. He wants to minister to us. He wants to enable us to become a seeking and a finding church. But he first of all wants to empower us to live the high standard which he set and be healed from the implications of the past. And I'm going to hand back.
Thanks, Steve.